TSN 1290, CFRW Winnipeg. All sports.
Step up and set the tone.
All the time. A division of Bell Media.
If you want to know the real deal about the three, we're going to take it with triple chop. We're going to bring you up to speed.
TSN 1290 presents the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg.
Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba. And for all those listening online at tsn1290.ca, good afternoon, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my two colleagues, Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Tim gets us on and off the air, like the expert that he is. 3 hours of hockey talk for you on this Saturday afternoon. The first hour will focus on the conference finals, which get underway in two different locales later on this afternoon and this evening. The second hour, Zach Bogosian, he's a restricted free agent. We conducted a contract analysis for him. We're going to discuss that for the second hour. Then the third hour, Craig Button on the NHL draft, which is upcoming, and some all the coaching changes and moves throughout the NHL. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And our website with the latest Stanley Cup final and Winnipeg Jets news is www.illegalcurve.com. Richie, Ezzy, before we get started, good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you both?
Doing good. It's a big day today. We got two conference finals starting off. It's great to be back doing the show. And we've got Craig Button on. That's awesome. We're going to have Mike Colligan on. Just really excited to break down these series because, as you guys know, we've got four former Cup winners, which is the first time that's happened, I believe. Shelley Anderson of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, who we've had on the show, tweeted that out. It's the first time the four previous Stanley Cup winners have been in the conference finals since the original six era. So it's pretty exciting. We've got, you know, the superpowers in the East and West competing for the Stanley Cup. So it's going to be fun. And as usual, we're going to break it down only like we can, I hope.
Richie, how you doing?
Well, no, I'm doing well, Drew. I think that what Eddie's talking about in terms of the past four Stanley Cup winners, I think also, maybe more importantly, is I think they're the four best teams in the National Hockey League. And I don't think it always happens that way, as we've seen in the past. So I do think it makes it more exciting, and the quality of hockey will be better.
I would agree with you in that front. Let's start, then, with the Eastern Conference. And that goes tonight in Pittsburgh, where the Pittsburgh Penguins will face off against the Boston Bruins in Game 1 of the Eastern Conference Finals. The Penguins won the season series against the Penguins. They took all three games. They went 3-0-0 against the Bruins. They won 3 one-goal games. The question I have to start this series breakdown is, do the Bruins have enough defense to neutralize the Penguins' offense?
I think that question can be asked both ways, though. But if you want to take it from that perspective of can the Bruins' defense defend the Pittsburgh offense, I think you have to look at the defense of the Bruins has never been necessarily the most balanced, meaning, you know, Chara is that horse. I think Johnny Boychuk, have said in the show many times, is an underrated defenseman. They had the likes of, you know, injury questions, of course, around Seidenberg and Ferentz, who were injured, but guys like Krug have come up, obviously played really well, Dougie Hamilton, and I think some of their backup younger guys, we said, I think, on the show 2 weeks ago, are actually better offensively than some of the veterans that they slide in there. But Drew, I think when you talk about the Boston Bruins, you can't just talk about their defense as a six-man unit, because to me, having watched all the teams, at least who came through town this year, the Boston Bruins are the best five-man unit in the National Hockey League, meaning their forwards and defensemen are in sync, and they play as well as any team. In fact, I think better than any team as a five-man unit. So I think matchups at the forward level and the defense are just as important here. You know, who is Bergeron playing against? How do they utilize the Bruins' fourth line? What does Chris Kelly do in this respect? How good is David Krejci? So I think that it's a good question. I think it's a question that needs to be asked, but I think it requires a complex answer.
You know, at the beginning of the segment, we were, you know, talking about how these are two previous Cup winners, not in the sense that they were the last 2 years, but Pittsburgh and Boston, obviously in 2009 and 2011. But these teams are arguably better than they were when they won the Cup. And Boston's a very similar team to the team that they were 2 years ago. But the only weakness that we've come across with the Boston Bruins throughout the year was their power play during the season was one of the worst in the league. Mm-hmm. But as far as their team defense and goaltending, I mean, even Khudobin was good as a backup for Tuukka Rask this year. But as far as their four lines, nobody rolls four lines. And I actually think they probably have more depth than Pittsburgh. But I think what you're going to find in this series, I'll be, you know, surprised if this isn't the case, because it's been the case all year, is Pittsburgh just might be offensively too much for any team to handle. And Tuukka Rask is a great goalie, and Chara was unbelievable versus the Rangers. But I just don't think you can shut down every line. You can put Brendan Morrow and Tyler Kennedy on your third line. They can beat you. Crosby, Kunitz, and Dupuy can beat you on that first line. Iggy, Malkin, and James Neal can hurt you on the second line. There's just so many different weapons on each line, and there's so many good players on each one of those lines that I think it just might be too much for them to handle. I think this is going to be, by the way, I think this will be a long series, and I think everyone's expecting it to be a long series. But to me, you know, Drew, you mentioned the team defense, and a guy like Chara, I think year after year, is a Norris finalist. He wasn't a Norris finalist this year, but
He's generally considered one of the top defensemen in the league.
Right, and you know, he's going to match up against Crosby. He'll probably match up against Malkin as well in that line. But I think, you know, when you get down to the pairings, Richie mentioned Seidenberg has injury questions. As we know, Andrew Ferentz didn't finish the series against the Rangers. So Torrey Krug was great. He came in and he had 4 points in his first five games. And you know, that's great. But now you're facing a different beast now. You're facing, you know, the big, bad Pittsburgh Penguins. And the Bruins, I think, will, you know, try to, as Richie said, they will try to work the Penguins down low and use maybe their size and physicality advantage. But I just think that when you get down to, you know, a guy like Crosby right now is flying, and Malkin was really good in that series, I think they're just going to be too much to handle offensively. And, you know, that's why I do think they will ultimately prevail. But I think Boston will definitely give them a good run for their money.
Richie, what worries you most from the Pittsburgh side of things? What worries you the most in this series?
Some people will point to the Thomas Vokoun issue. You know, has he done it before? But he's played quite well. Obviously, Fleury faltered and has faltered in the past little while, playoffs-wise. I think it's the Pittsburgh defense against Boston's offense. And by that, again, it's a five-man unit. But Pittsburgh, I don't think, plays as well as a five-man unit. They run around a bit in their own zone. You know, they have a lot of guys who think offense, which is great, but when you're sustained pressure by Boston, big guys below the hash marks, it's tough sometimes when they're cheating a little bit. And I think when you look at Pittsburgh's defense as a whole, and it's Paul Martin with Brooks Orpik, as it was last game, they played about 3 weeks ago, Mark Eden and Chris Letang, and Doug Murray and Matt Niskanen. I mean, I see flaws. Chris Letang's had a great year. He's really good offensively, but you can work him on the boards. He's not a big guy. He's not the strongest guy. Doug Murray, not a great skater, you know, doesn't handle the puck that well. Brooks Orpik, you can pressure him. He can turn the puck over a bit. Paul Martin is a nice puck mover. He can move around the ice well. Not the strongest guy in the world. And Mark Eden's limited, especially offensively. And you have Matt Niskanen, a guy you can move the puck and shoot the puck. But, again, not a guy that you can't take advantage of on the board. So there are flaws in this defense that I think match up quite well if you're a Boston fan because of the size of the Bruins. Oh, obviously size and skill. I mean, size is one thing, but the size and skill combination that they have, not only players as a the team as a whole, the forwards as a whole, but, I mean, particular players like Milan Lucic and guys who can hit, can do everything, it's going to cause some problems. So, I mean, you have a little bit of a speed problem. I think sometimes against Boston, the teams skate around them a bit, and Boston's more of a size team. So, to me, there's a very interesting mix for this series.
Let me ask you both this question. Which team, the Bruins or the Penguins, when you look at them on paper, which team has more flaws in it?
I think I'll answer that for the question first, Drew.
Because from my perspective, when you break it down, I think it can be said with a reasonable argument that it's the Penguins who have more flaws than the Bruins.
I don't agree, because I think if you look at the teams as a whole, you could point out some issues with their defense. I think you probably have more questions about Pittsburgh's goaltending than Boston's, but Boston is an ironclad. Although I like Rask, don't get me wrong. But when you look at the forwards, they're both really deep, but Pittsburgh has the top-end talent. And I think at the end of the day, you're probably picking the top-end talent.
I think Drew's got a point there. And I touched on it a little bit, though, Drew.
Okay.
I do think that depth-wise, top to bottom, Boston's a better team. And what I mean by that is, I know people probably listening and saying, what's this guy talking about? That probably
happens. You might be saying that all the time.
Yeah, that might happen on a weekly basis, because sometimes I think I don't know what I'm talking about. But I think, yeah, if you look at, the forward lines, we know that Boston, Claude Julien loves rolling four forward lines. But, let's say that Dennis Seidenberg and Andrew Ferentz are in the lineup. But even if it's Torrey Krug and Dougie Hamilton, or even, God forbid, Wade Redden gets back in the lineup.
Oh, he's terrible.
They have a solid team top to bottom. Better goaltender. Better top defenseman, arguably. I think Chara overall over Letang.
Yeah.
Letang is leading the NHL in scoring right now, or he's second, whatever he's at right now, is 16 points. But defensively, Chara is better.
Yeah.
So if you look at the top players, so where's the obvious equalizer is Crosby and Malkin.
Mm-hmm.
I think they have the two best offensive players in the NHL, and that is the equalizer for me. But if you were to compare, the three major areas, goaltending, defense, forwards, I think Boston gets two of those three. But I think Pittsburgh, that's the equalizer. Crosby and Malkin can take over a game, Crosby specifically, like nobody else.
Let's talk a little bit about Pittsburgh up to this point. And I think you start with Pittsburgh against the Islanders. The Islanders gave them problems because they were a skating team, a skilled team, and they played a little bit of a race, a scoring race.
Mm-hmm. 1980s style playoff.
Yeah, similar to how Philly beat them last year. And Pittsburgh talked all season about how they were disciplined and they weren't going to let that happen. And then, of course, it happened in the first round. I mean, they won two overtime games, right, guys? Those go the other way. They're not even in the playoffs anymore. So think about it that way. But Boston isn't a team that causes problems like that. Then you look at Ottawa. Ottawa is more similar to Boston than the Islanders are to Boston in terms of the style of play.
Offense, the systems.
The difference in Ottawa as compared to Boston is that Boston is more offensively talented than the Senators. You could argue about defense, and obviously Carlson wasn't 100%. Anderson had a great year, wasn't great in that series. But Boston, their forwards are better, significantly better, in my opinion, than Ottawa's. So Pittsburgh's going to have a little bit of a mix here in terms of what they've faced in the past two rounds, more so of the Ottawa mix than the Islanders mix. So if you're looking at it from the perspective of what has beat Pittsburgh the past two, last year, Philly beat them in a kind of a scoring race,
mm-hmm.
right, a shootout.
Yeah.
A team like Boston isn't going to have a shootout kind of style. So maybe that serves well. That serves Pittsburgh well, because if it's an organized system they're playing against, they may be able to take advantage of it. The coaches, I know we're getting Mike Colligan on the other side here, but the coaches here, to me, are both terrific coaches. I don't think there's an edge in that regard either. I don't, because that's going to be a focus. You watch Game 3 and 4, those television cameras are going to be all over Claude Julien and Dan Bylsma, because they're both tacticians and they're very good at what they do. But I think they're both very good at what they do. And I don't think there's an edge there.
You want to do your predictions now, or you want to save it till after Mike?
Let's do it now.
Okay, predictions. Ezzy, I'll start with you. How do you have it?
This will be a 7-game series. I'll take the Pens in 7.
Richie?
I will also take the Pens in 7.
Make it a clean sweep. I also have the Penguins in 7. So we're either all going to be right or we're all going to be wrong. Let's go to break. When we come back on the other side, Mike Colligan from thehockeywriters.com is going to join us to talk Bruins Penguins. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and www.illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show hotline.
We welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He's our good friend. He writes for thehockeywriters.com. He covers the Pittsburgh Penguins. Mike Colligan. Mike, good afternoon. How you doing, bud?
I'm doing pretty well. It's glad to have some hockey to talk about here. It seems like a long break, especially in this short and compressed season that we get 8 days between series, but hopefully looking forward to the doubleheader tonight.
Absolutely. If you can explain to me the NHL scheduling of these conference finals, you're a smarter man than I am. You might be a smarter man than I am anyways, but if you can answer that riddle, then you certainly win a prize. Mike, we got to start. Obviously, we're bringing you on to talk about the Penguins-Bruins conference finals matchup. From your perspective, what is the biggest flaw on each of these two teams?
Yeah, that's a good question, Drew. I think there's definite flaws on both teams. Before getting to either of those, I think it's really going to come down to who can gain offensive zone time, offensive zone pressure, because I think that's where one of these teams will get that advantage and be able to wear down the other team. I think on Boston, I just don't see the defensive depth that's really going to be able to handle the Penguins. Torrey Krug was the big story in that round against the Rangers, but you think of where that round was played, it was mostly in the Rangers' end. The Rangers are very passive A lot of the gameplay takes place in their own end, and they're very happy with that. But that's where Torrey Krug can excel. And I think if the Penguins can get a guy like Krug or Matt Barkowski or some of the younger defensemen on the Bruins roster to play in their own end for 45 seconds every shift, I think we're going to see some holes in that unit that we really didn't know were there. And I think that's going to be one of the biggest concerns for Boston in this series. If I look at the Penguins, I think it's the exact opposite. They have some trouble when teams are able to sustain time in their own zone. The breakout's not great, so they try to get, they have a rule, 8 seconds and out of the zone. They want to be out of that defensive zone as quickly as possible, and oftentimes that leads to turnovers, which we saw in the New York Islanders series. So I think the Penguins match up very well against Boston, but there's certainly some concerns if Boston's able to get to that puck possession game, sustain some zone time, and really throw a 40-45 shot to Thomas Vokoun in this series.
Mike, you had a great article on the Hockey Writers, and we'll hopefully get Michael Remus to tweet that out right now. You did a systems breakdown. I really enjoyed reading it, and I recommend everybody that's listening should go check that article out. Again, we'll link it out. You wrote about the Bruins forecheck, and I know Richie's been talking about this all year because the Bruins were in town a couple years, and they seem to just punish the Jets' defense with their forecheck, all those big forwards that they have. They seem to have them in abundance. How do you think Pittsburgh is going to attempt to defend against the Bruins' forecheck?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that might be a big turning point in this series is how that matchup plays out. I think when you look at the Penguins' playoffs so far, they played the New York Islanders in the first round, and the Islanders, I give them a lot of credit. They came in with a great game plan. I think maybe that's part of being a division opponent, as you know the other teams in your division very well, but they were able to just really give the Penguins trouble. Over 19 periods in that series, I gave the Islanders probably 14 of them, and it's unbelievable to think that an 8 seed could have that much of an advantage, but I think it was a lot of their forecheck. They threw so many different looks at the Penguins that they couldn't figure out where guys were coming from, and that gave them a lot of trouble. In the second round, I think it was very much the opposite, where Ottawa was very structured, a little more passive. Penguins defensemen knew exactly where the forwards are going to be. They're a little bit quicker. They were able to make passes and break out of the zone very easily. And I think we're going to see more of the same with Boston, assuming they don't change their game plan, which they don't seem to do very much. They're more structured. They're a very patient, you know, passive team in the neutral zone, oftentimes trapping. And I think that's an advantage for Pittsburgh. They don't like the pressure. They like when they have time to make it a pass to one of their open players and get the puck into the offensive zone. So I think we're going to see more Ottawa than Islanders from this Bruins forecheck.
Mike, you talk in the article as well about Pittsburgh's breakout and how important that's going to be. And I guess also, you know, the point is the breakout that they have when they're facing pressure, the forecheck we just mentioned, and also, I guess, a little bit more of an organized breakout, which you mentioned about that as well. And when the Pittsburgh was in town a lot, you could see the Penguins fly that puck up to the opposing blue line almost and either tip it in like most teams seem to do these days or even pass it back against the grain to a center or a winger cutting through the zone. So they seem to have a lot of variations. Can you talk about how important Pittsburgh's breakout is going to be in facing the Bruins?
Yeah, it is going to be important. And I think, you know, from a broad perspective, the Penguins' game plan is to force that puck through the neutral zone again as quickly as possible. And like you said, tip the puck in, do whatever you need to do to get it behind the Bruins defense. If you think of a guy like Zdeno Chara that's playing 30 minutes a night, hard matchups, it's much easier for him if he only has to go back to the red line or his own blue line, and then a turnover, he's able to go back and play defense on the Penguins' blue line. That's very little skating for him. And I know the Penguins' game plan to target him is to get the puck behind him, make him go back 20 times a game, make him take a number of big hits. It'll start to wear on him, and maybe not in game one or two, but we saw him wearing down in that New York Rangers series, and the Rangers don't have nearly the speed and the pressure on the forecheck that the Penguins do. So I know that's what their game plan is if they can make Seidenberg go back over and over again and Chara really have to skate and play a tough 30 minutes, I think that's going to start to swing in the Penguins' favor as this series moves on to game 4 or 5.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. We're joined by Mike Colligan. He covers the Pittsburgh Penguins for thehockeywriters.com. Mike, you know, you look at the numbers, the Penguins' power play with that roster of all-stars and Hall of Famers, number one in the NHL throughout the playoffs at 28.3% success rate. The Boston penalty kill, sort of middle of the pack, 81.1% for number 8 in the NHL in the playoffs. You know, what do the Bruins have to do to try and neutralize the Penguins' power play?
When I've seen the Penguins' power play struggle in the past, it's when they've gotten a lot of quick pressure. And I think that's one thing that Boston's penalty kill does very good, is they get on the puck quickly, and they're very structured in how they rotate and take away the passing options that players have on the power play. And so normally I would say that's definitely an advantage for the Bruins, but I've seen kind of an evolution of the Penguins' power play in this playoffs run here. They've got so much talent on that top unit, like you said, that they've become much more improvisational. There's so much that they can work five options from all over the ice, lots of rotations, and I think that's going to give Boston a little bit of trouble because Boston is so structured in their attack that you can't game plan for a team that doesn't really have a game plan on the power play. And I think that's what's going to be frustrating for a lot of the Bruins, is when you're running around with that much pressure. We've watched NHL hockey enough. When you have that much talent on the power play unit that's able to move the puck quickly, I think that's key. That's where the penalty kill can be a little bit too over-aggressive, and then you really let up some significant scoring chances. I mean, when you look at James Neal, who led the league in power play goals last year, he really hadn't done much in the playoffs until the end of that Ottawa series, and then he had 5 goals in 2 games and really looked like he kicked back into another level, and that's got to be scary, I think, for Boston, is when you look at Jerome Iginla one-timing from one side, Evgeny Malkin with a big shot on the other side, James Neal parked in the slot, and a guy like Chris Kunitz in front. What do you do? How do you handle that, because you've got one less guy on the ice? That's going to be a big challenge for Boston.
Mike, towards the end of the article, you talked about the matchups, and you specifically mentioned that the key to the series for you is Boston defenseman Andrew Ferentz and whether he plays, and I agree with you totally. I think that's a huge loss for them defensively. And you talk about the matchups, you know, will Julien match up Char and Seidenberg against Crosby, or will he decide to match up Boychuk and Bartkowski against Crosby, or will he go, you know, with them against the Malkin, Neal, Iginla line? But without Ferentz there, we wanted to ask you about Patrice Bergeron. He's a pretty good offensive player, but he's also a very good defensive player. Who do you think he's going to be assigned as far as shutting down? Is it going to be Crosby, Malkin? What do you see his role, his defensive role in this series?
Yeah, Eddie, that's a good question because, you know, I don't think they have the defensive pairs to shut down both lines. And so I think what you might see is Char and Seidenberg take one of the lines. I think they should take the Malkin line, but I think Char might be a little bit too stubborn and insist that he can shut down Crosby. It didn't happen in the regular season. Crosby had some great success versus him. But I think Char is going to want to see if he can handle that matchup. And then we're going to see Bergeron's line kind of be the shutdown pair on the other line, whatever that is. I think that they'll become kind of a defensive unit. And to me, the biggest problem with that is if you're a defensive unit and you're only focused on shutting down a line, what does that mean for Boston's offense? Are they able to score? Because I don't see the depth, the scoring depth in the Boston forward unit that can really pick up the slack if Bergeron's line is focused solely on defense. And there was Dan Bylsma said the other day that in the 2009 Stanley Cup Finals, it was the exact same situation where Mike Babcock insisted on putting Henrik Zetterberg on Crosby and shutting him down, making sure he couldn't score. Well, Zetterberg did nothing in the series offensively, and that was a big key to Detroit having success. And I don't know that Boston is going to get enough scoring to really keep up with whatever matchups they decide to pursue. They can't continue getting, you know, I think they've got 13 goals from defensemen so far in this playoff, and it's really overshadowing one of the weaknesses on their team, which is, I think, is scoring depth. And so if they have Bergeron in that role, you wonder where the scoring is going to come from. They're going to need a guy like Chris Kelly to step up on one of those middle lines and get some timely goals for them if they want to win some games.
Mike, do you see Claude Julien keeping Char and Seidenberg together all series? You see him kind of rotating in and out of that pairing.
I think the key is getting Ferentz back. If they can get Ferentz back, they can afford to put him with Boychuk and afford to keep Char and Seidenberg together. But when you think of him being out of the lineup, now you're talking about if you keep Char and Seidenberg together, your second pair against the Malkin line is Johnny Boychuk and Matt Bartkowski, rookie defenseman. It's just a bad matchup for them, and I think that's going to be the biggest problem, is what do they do, how do they shut them down, and how do you keep Zdeno Chara's minutes at a reasonable level if he's, again, playing all of those tough minutes retrieving pucks in the breakout?
Mike, we'll let you go on this one final question. I bet you could predict what the question's going to be, and that is, we want your prediction as to how this series unfolds and who's the winner and how many games.
Yeah, you know, I was going back and forth early in the season. I thought it would be Penguins and Boston in the Eastern Conference Finals. Eastern Conference was pretty wide open, but they looked like the cream of the crop. And here we are, and I think I really like the matchup for Pittsburgh. I think they're winning five games. And what's funny is I looked at teams that were giving the Penguins trouble this year, and it was a lot of quick transition teams. And I looked at a team like Toronto that I think would have beaten the Penguins if they had faced them in this playoff run. I think Toronto had the right mix of players, the right game plan and style to give the Penguins a ton of trouble. But fortunately, the Penguins were able to avoid them. They got through a pretty quick and painless series against Ottawa. And I think this one will go five games, and the Penguins will make it to the finals.
So I guess, Mike, on top of that, if we don't have you back on, which we hope if they do win the series, we hope to have you back on. But you're kind of saying that Chicago may be an issue for Pittsburgh if they make it through and they face the Blackhawks?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, you look at L.A. and what they've been through, St. Louis in the first round, San Jose in the second round. If somehow they can survive Chicago, I don't know that they have enough left in the tank to really handle this Penguins team.
Mike Colligan from thehockeywriters.com. He covers the Pittsburgh Penguins. Thanks very much for joining us this afternoon on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Sure thing, guys. Take care.
Take care, Mike. Thanks very much. Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Thank you to Mike Colligan, HockeyWriters.com, for that breakdown of the Penguins-Bruins series. In case you missed any of that, it will be available later on both TheLegalCurve.com and on TSN1290.ca. This segment of the program is brought to you by the Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba. The CGA Association of Manitoba is the largest, fastest-growing, and most diverse accounting body in the province. Did you know that CGAs are among the top 5% of income earners in Canada? For more information, contact the CGA Association of Manitoba at cga-manitoba.org or give them a call 204-477-1256. The CGA Association of Manitoba, we see more than numbers.
Drew, on that last interview,
yeah,
Mike is terrific. We were talking about that off air. We've had him on probably more than anybody now at this point. I was with him up until he said the Leafs were going to beat the Penguins, though. I was
he
with
said
Mike.
They were going to give him a hard time.
No, I'm just joking. I'm just bugging you, Mike. But no, it was a great preview of the series because Pittsburgh handled the Boston Bruins a lot in the regular season, and I think he nailed it. Mike nailed it.
Well, he said five
Andrew
games.
Ferentz,
which...
Not having a guy like Andrew Ferentz, that's huge.
He said it was going to be a five-game series, which is a lot quicker than I think most prognosticators have been saying so far. We'll see, obviously, who is right. The other series starting tonight in the Western Conference, the Chicago Blackhawks against the Los Angeles Kings. The Chicago was 2-1 against L.A. this season, outscoring them 12-9, with the big win being on opening night in L.A., where the Blackhawks spoiled the Kings' banner-raising celebration with a 5-2 opening night win. You know, my question for you, can the Blackhawks defense, after what you saw of the Blackhawks defense against Detroit, can they handle the size of the Los Angeles Kings forwards in this series?
I think, again, it goes both ways. Can the Kings defense handle the speed of the Chicago forwards?
Doesn't that, sorry for interrupting, doesn't that indicate how close most of these series are expected to be?
Well, close but different.
Okay. Yeah, different series, but...
Well, not necessarily even the series. I mean, the series have some similarities. The differences in terms of the matchups, like the defenses, the questions, can the defenses handle different strengths of the other team, whether it be skating or size? There's skill. I think we can agree there's skill in all four teams.
Oh, obviously.
So that's not the question here. There's no Cinderella stories here. These are, to me, the four best teams in the National Hockey League.
Mm-hmm.
But the strength of the Pittsburgh and Chicago is really the speed and skill. And L.A. and Boston is size and skill.
Mm-hmm.
Makes it interesting.
To me, Drew, the entire key to the series, and this is not anything, you know, mind-boggling, is Corey Crawford.
Sure.
It really is. Because I've been a huge Corey Crawford fan. You guys know, before the season started, I picked the Blackhawks to win the Cup and all that. So I'm going to toot my horn right now. But, you know, Corey Crawford...
sound effect there. Yeah.
Corey Crawford gave up that goal in Game 6... and the Hawks ended up winning. But you guys remember that goal, the knuckle puck, the knuckler. Everybody remembers that puck. And Don Cherry was on CBC, and he was standing up for Corey Crawford, which was impressive because it was a knuckle puck. But it was a bad goal. It was a soft goal. But Corey Crawford you know, overall in the playoffs, it's been pretty darn good.
I mean, LA is number one in goals against. Chicago's right. Number two.
Right, and Jonathan Quick right now, in my opinion, is the early Conn Smythe favorite for the way he has played. Just really quickly, I mean, the Chicago-Detroit series, guys, was a fantastic series. Chicago comes back from 3-1 and all that. But the LA-San Jose series, you know, 5 out of 7 games were one-goal games. And to me, I love that type of hockey because, you know, Matt Green's back. We talked about that.
Huge.
They just have a tough physical team, and they love to hit. And they finish their checks. Everybody, Dustin Brown, Dustin Penner, I mean, Mike Richards, Jeff Carter. These guys are, like, the LA Kings might have the most playoff-ready team, you know, in the last 10 years. I mean, they're built for the playoffs. They are, and they won the Stanley Cup, you know, as proof of that. But I look at, you know, the Chicago Blackhawks, and now they face some adversity. But Jonathan Quick was unbelievable in that series. To me, you know, he was by and far the MVP of that series. And I think that Chicago now has faced some adversity. They've come back from down 3-1, and they've won a lot of close games, you know, the overtime game and Game 7, of course. But I think now, you know, Taves and Kane are starting to go. I really think that this is going to be a really close series, and I do ultimately think Chicago is going to win. And the only reason I could see the Chicago Blackhawks not winning the series is if Corey Crawford lets in a couple bad goals and has a couple bad games.
I'm not so sure it's just on Crawford. Yeah, I think you look at, first of all, if you look at who Chicago's faced. Chicago's faced a Minnesota team that is pretty flawed defensively.
Yeah.
And then they played against a Detroit team that is really, really skilled defensively but very young. And Minnesota, of course, relies on Brodin a lot. So you're going from a team, the two teams that you've played against who have, to me, flaws defensively, to a team in L.A. that doesn't have those flaws. Cromwell's great. He's not Drew Doughty. Ryan Suter's great. You could argue he's Drew Doughty or not. But then the secondary players in the team add the mix of size and speed. So Voinov has been arguably the best defenseman in the NHL playoffs thus far.
Yep.
Regier, solid defenseman.
Just signed a two-year deal.
Scuderi, solid defenseman. Matt Green adds that physical component on the third pairing. That's just, to me, is vital to what they're doing. It takes pressure off the other guys. You can take off a couple minutes on the other, on the top end guys. So LA, Chicago has not faced a defense like LA's. I mean, Detroit is not a physical defense, aside from Cronwell, really.
Mm-hmm.
Erickson has become more physical over the years, but not that physical. Minnesota, sure, but they're just not a good defense.
Minnesota wasn't in it to win it.
So you play the 8 and 7 seeds, and you have that right by being first overall. But how do you fare against a team that just, to me, is heads and tails above the two teams that you faced? All due respect to Detroit.
Chicago, Chicago narrowly beat Detroit, obviously, went to Game 7, overtime of Game 7. But if Chicago plays in that way, I don't think we've seen the best of Chicago yet. But if they play, if they don't play their best, I don't think they can beat L.A.
So let's talk about L.A.'s forwards for a second here against Chicago's defense.
And I think that's a big matchup right there.
And, you know, Seabrook's a big guy, strong guy. Chalmerson, bigger, strong guy. Keith is certainly won't back down from anybody, but a little more slender. Johnny Oduya's not the biggest guy in the world. And Nick Leddy and Michael Roosevelt, you know, Leddy hasn't become what they wanted him to become. At the end of the day, they moved back to Seabrook Keith. They didn't want to spread it around, at least for last game. Roosevelt, to me, can be taken advantage of. He's not the fastest guy. He takes some stupid penalties.
I think you're being generous there. Roosevelt was clearly their weak defenseman in the Detroit series.
Anyway, he's not very good. So you look at LA's forwards, and then you say, what's the strength of this team? Well, I mean, LA's so balanced. And don't get me wrong, I think Chicago's a great team. We're going to talk about them in a second. But, you know, guys like Penner and Carter and Dustin Brown and Kopitar, Justin Williams, he may not be the biggest guy in that team, but he's might be the best player along the boards.
Mm-hmm. He's strong.
We didn't talk about Mike Richards and then King, and then what do they do with Nolan Richardson?
Yeah.
They're going to hammer that puck below the hash marks like they always do, and they're going to work it down low. The issue is they were able to do that. I mean, San Jose doesn't have a great defense, but they were able to do that against Pietrangelo, Bouwmeester, Shattenkirk.
A good St. Louis defense.
Barrett Jackman, a balanced St. Louis defense.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying Chicago's isn't balanced, but I'm not sure you wouldn't take St. Louis's over Chicago. LA didn't dominate that series by any means. But I think the size, and we've talked to Jesse Rogers about it from CSN Chicago, they have issues sometimes with guys with size and, of course, puck control. So I think LA is going to cause problems. Now, having said that, Chicago's speed, Hossa, Kane, Taves, all those guys, they're going to work it around LA's defense, because LA's defense isn't the fastest defense up there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be that interplay. And, of course, you have game breakers on both sides. That's why it's hard. I mean, the forward groups may be different, but they're both, to me, it's a ton of skill. Chicago's more overall pure skill, but I'm not so sure I can rely on it on a night-to-night basis, some of those guys.
How important is the transition game for Chicago to get the puck, you know, if it's in their zone, to get it out real quick? How important is that if they get bogged down against the boards, having to win puck battles, you know, below the hash marks in their own zone? How much does that play into LA's advantage?
Well, it's important, Richie. I'll let you get in here quickly, Drew. It's really important because if you're the Chicago Blackhawks and, you know, you beat the Detroit Red Wings, you saw what LA did to San Jose, and you know, even though they've got physical players, I mean, Duncan Keith, for all he does offensively, is a guy that can lay a body check, so can Jarmelson. And you've got physical players on the team. But overall, Chicago is not a very physical team. Mm-hmm. They're not, and LA is. So if you're Chicago and you saw the LA-San Jose series, or you've played LA more so, but you're not going to get into that game where Chicago and Detroit were getting into a little bit. And I think that's what happened earlier in the series. I think guys like Taves and Kane were getting off their game, and Taves was trying to play that physical game, and that's not his game. So I think it's extremely important. You know, a lot has been talked about the puck possession game and the speed of the Chicago Blackhawks. And the reason why it's so important, especially against a team like this, is because you don't want to give them the opportunity to wear you down. And that's what it's a really fascinating thing about hockey to me in the playoffs, is there's a lot, you know, you talk about like dump and chase hockey. And what happens with a team like the LA Kings is, the LA Kings are a fast team too. But what they'll do is guys like Richards and Carter dump the puck in, make the defenseman, you know, come around, and then they'll just punish them again and again, check them into the boards. Why do they do that, Drew? Well, they're trying to wear them down, and they'll do that early in the series. They'll do it often. Mm-hmm. They'll do it throughout the series. But it is extremely important for Chicago to not get in that type of game, and I don't assume that they will. Pardon me, don't expect them, I should say, to get into that kind of game, that style of game. But I do think that if you don't have guys like Jonathan Taves and Patrick Kane going, which I do think they will, then this series could be completely different. But what you mentioned, you didn't think that Chicago, we've seen Chicago's best. I agree with you, but I do think it came out in Game 7, and that's when they were playing the best that they've played so far. And that's what I expect. I'm going to pick them. I guess we'll wait till the next segment. But
I want to talk after the break about what I think the key difference in the series will be.
Let's do that. After the break, Richard's key difference in the Kings-Blackhawks series. You're listening to TSN 1290 and the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Before the top of the hour, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. This segment is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. For over 25 years, Rumors has been Winnipeg's home for the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Just added, it was sold out so quickly, they've added three more shows for Steve-O from Jackass. That's Wednesday, August the 14th, and two shows, Sunday, August the 18th. So you can see Steve-O three more times if you missed out on the opportunity to do it before. Please, gentlemen, make fun of my age, because I can see it coming from a mile away.
Wow. Well, that music should always be played. Here we go. You got it again, Timmy. Well, I love that we've got music from your era, the era you grew up in, the 1930s. This is just terrific. This is, you know, this is swing, isn't it?
I saw that one coming. As soon as I heard the music start, I saw that one.
Drew's coming. A swinger, too, so.
Anyways, Richie, before the break, you wanted to talk about the key difference in the series.
I was going to say, this is from the Mask soundtrack, isn't it?
Remus.
Hold on, Remus. This isn't the warm-up with Hustler. What are you doing here?
Remus, lock that door, please. Somebody lock that door.
Key difference in the series, Richie.
You know, we talk about, will this player get going, that player get going. I think Kopitar also factors into that. I think he can play better. Dustin Brown, of course, as well. But I think on Chicago and L.A., that goes both ways. I think it's a seven-game series. And I mean, I should admit I picked L.A. to face Pittsburgh in the final. I'm going to stick with that. I'm not going to change my prediction now. But this is why I think L.A. will win, and they'll win in seven. So giving my prediction there now.
Gotcha.
I think the biggest difference is the second-pairing defense for these teams. And to me, it's if they play Keith and Seabrook together, I like to see. I assume they're going to, based on the last game. Oduya and Chalmerson. to me, and I like Chalmerson. He's not good with the puck, though. And Oduya is a turnover guy.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's funny because he actually is good with the puck when he moves it up the ice.
But it's going to be a pressure, big guys, and he's not big.
Yep.
I think that second pairing is going to be the difference vis-a-vis Slavovoynov and Rob Scuderi.
And you're talking about the big line, not the top line necessarily, because Williams and Kopitar and Brown Brown was actually on the third line at certain points against the Sharks. But what Richie's talking about is Mike Richards, Jeff Carter, Dustin Penner. That line against Oduya Jarmelson, right, Richie?
Mm-hmm.
And that line has really been, again, their best line. I mean, guys, Dustin Brown's got 4 points in the playoffs so far. Kopitar only has 7 points.
Mm-hmm.
These guys really haven't got going yet.
And
it's funny because in the Eastern Conference, I mean, sure, you had Tyler Seguin for the Bruins, and he's only got one goal and all that, but Taves and Kane haven't been, you know, dominant by any stretch of the imagination. And that's what's so funny about, you know, this series. Both of these teams are so deep that, you know, they can get contributions from so many different players and still be successful. I mean, it's unbelievable to me. We talked about this last week. You know, Taves has one goal. I mean, like, you'd expect him to have at least 5 or 6 goals, right? But the team is successful. And I think Richie's bang on. I think that, you know, the defensive depth of the LA Kings is so impressive. And Willie Mitchell hasn't been in the lineup for a long time. And, you know, they acquired Robin Regier and Keaton Ellerbe. Keaton Ellerbe hasn't played that much. But you mentioned Voyanov. I mean, the LA Kings are a very well-built machine from the goal out. They really are.
You mentioned the second defensive pairing. And watching the Blackhawks-Red Wings series, I couldn't help but think that, you know, they had Oduya, Chalmerson to a lesser extent, but Oduya especially, was so turnover-prone and had trouble against Detroit's forwards that going up against LA's forwards who, I mean, I don't think you can argue very much that LA's, you know, depth forwards are better than Detroit's depth forwards.
Yes.
I just said, how is this guy going to handle it? How is he not going to do something that leaves Blackhawks fans shaking their head at this is their top four defenseman?
That is my, I mean, overall he's fine. I think this matchup is a bad one for him.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you look at one thing I think that Chicago will rely on is their depth lines, because let's talk about it. I mean, they are deep, and I think they have more scoring, of course, on their bottom guys than LA does. Andrew Shaw, Brandon Saad, and Victor Stahlberg playing together. Well, interesting to see what they do with, you know, some of their grittier guys. Do they throw one or two of the guys in to offset LA, or do they try and play their game, which is speed and skill? But Stahlberg, Shaw, and Saad against a third pairing of Green and Muzzin, which I like, but that speed element on Chicago could really counteract LA's more physical bottom pair, which isn't the best skating combination. But when you're really talking about the top end guys, lines one and two for each team, if Chicago, I don't know what they're going to do for lines wise, and you never really know till the games start, but I really do believe that LA's second line should be able to take better advantage of Chicago's second pairing than Chicago will be able to take advantage of LA's second pairing. And I think in a series which I think will go very long and will be a tough one, that's going to show itself over the course of, you know, once you get to games, maybe one or two, maybe not, you'll see. But over the course of the series, I think it'll mean a difference of a couple goals.
Chicago's power play throughout the entire playoffs, and the regular season for that matter, hasn't been very good, especially looking at the roster of talent they have there. 10th in the playoffs, 16.2%. If they get that power play, or how key is it to them winning if they to get that power play going?
I think they don't even really need to have a good power play. Remember when the Pittsburgh Penguins won the Cup? I always go back to that. I know I do. But they didn't have a good power play in 09 because they're such a good 5-on-5 team. I do think it's important, Drew. But you look back to the playoffs. Pardon me, the playoffs. We're talking about the playoffs. Dumb. In the second round.
You're talking to yourself
against
now?
Against the San Jose Sharks. Remember they had killed off all of those penalties up until, what was it, game 3?
Mm-hmm.
I think their penalty kill is just fantastic. And you know what? I do agree, Rich, with you, Richie, about the matchups. So you're talking about the LA Kings second line versus the Oduya Jarmelson pairing. But I think for me, again, I mentioned, you know, Corey Crawford. He's got to be, you know, as good as he's been so far. He let in that bad goal in Game 6, but he's got to be good.
He's been good.
Because he's not going to be better than Quick. Quick's a better goalie. There aren't too many goalies out there now that aren't as good as Quick.
He's has to right as now, as far as I'm concerned.
Quick, unbelievable. He's an extreme talent. I just want to say one thing quickly, and then I'll give it back to you, the MC.
Thank you.
I think this series, for me, it's super close. I have set the series in 7 games too, Richie, but I think that to me the Hawks will score more goals. You know, simply put, obviously, if they're going to win, they'll score more goals. But I think L.A., it really concerns me that Dustin Brown and Anže Kopitar have not been playing at a very high level. You're talking about, you know, again, Kopitar has only got 7 points and Brown's got 4. To me, Brown, there's something wrong with Brown. He's still playing his physical game, but he doesn't have that spark that he had last year. I don't know what it is. But I think that, you know, ultimately Taves and Kane and Sharp and Hossa, it's going to be too much for the L.A. Kings to handle. Plus, they've got home ice, so...
You said that Jonathan Quick right now is playing Hasek-like.
Yeah.
You know, then fill in the blank for me. The LA Kings need to score X number of goals per game on Corey Crawford to win this series.
3 to win. And it's not necessarily that out there because in the NHL, you know, a lot of these games are 2-1, 3-2. But I think Chicago's a high-powered attack, and I think they're going to get some goals against this team. But I think L.A. also can score. And I think some of the guys, as you mentioned, I think will get going. I think on both sides they'll get going. But I think 3 goals, if you score 3 goals a game, like, I don't think Quick gives up 3 goals a game.
He's just 4 goals a game then.
He's just too good right now. I mean, he is confident. He kind of, if you watch him, he takes away that bottom of the ice like Hasek, and he'll do it in weird ways, and he's flexible, and he's aggressive. And he has the swagger, is he? And
yep.
Does it really matter if anybody else does the way he's going?
I don't think there's even... anybody out there right now that would question he's America's number one goalie going into the Olympics. I mean, it's not even close.
Craig Anderson's ahead of Ryan Miller.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ryan Miller could even be third, but Jonathan Quick in Sochi is...
Yeah, no.
He's the best goalie in that tournament.
The U.S. right now probably has the depth that Canada had,
yep,
you know, a decade ago and you know, 15 years ago when they first started going to the Olympics.
Probably right about that.
Yeah, but right now it's Jonathan Quick. I mean, it looks like, you know, he doesn't expect to give up any goals. You know,
he doesn't, Drew, and I think we've talked about all the other factors, but I think Crawford's really played well. But that'll be the big test, because Quick has shown throughout the playoffs, in the past, but throughout the playoffs, you know, the terrible turnover in Game 1 to Alex Steen.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
The stupid decision was a Game 2. Something happened with the puck. I forget what it was. Anyhow, he's made a couple of stupid plays or letting bad goals, whatever it may be. Doesn't faze him.
Gets angry.
Is able to get over it. You know, maybe not in the Grant Fuhr way of saying, you know, kind of water off a duck's back, but he gets angry, as you said, Drew, and it motivates him in that way. So can Crawford match him? If Crawford matches Quick, Chicago's going to win.
Yeah.
I just don't see it happening, although it'll be tight.
Quickly. Daryl Sutter,
no
or
pun
Joel,
intended, right?
Daryl Sutter or Joel Quenneville. Which of those two would you rather have behind the bench?
I think they're both excellent coaches, Drew. I think the 4 coaches left in the playoffs are, you could argue, are, aside from Mike Babcock, the, you know, well, him included, top 5 coaches in the league.
Quenneville's a great coach. I have a soft spot for the Sutter family, though. I just love Daryl Sutter because I think he gets the best out of players. I mean, yeah, look at Robin Regier comes to L.A. It's like it's 2004 on Calgary all over again. I think he is a master motivator. It's funny, he was joking about the Detroit-Chicago series. They asked him, you know, about the game, and he said, I hope they go to triple overtime. I don't know if you guys saw that, but both great coaches, though.
I'll have you know that there's a lot of talk in the hockey circles about Joel Quenneville. Communication between coaching and coaches and management in Chicago is pretty poor. And
Quenneville and the Bowmans don't get along.
And more than that, apparently, and then there's been talk that, you know, had they lost that Game 7, he would have been done.
Right.
So he's feeling that pressure. Does that galvanize the coaching unit? You don't know, but I think that's an interesting backstory to take into account because to me, if Chicago loses in this round, the management, I know we're up against a break here, management could use this as, we should have won the cup, we can get rid of you. And it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out.
Quickly to recap, you have?
LA in 7.
Ezzy?
I'm going to go Hawks in 7.
And I'm going to go LA in 7 as well. That's it for our conference finals preview. When we come back, we're going to spend some time discussing Zach Bogosian and his RFA contract analysis. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. 1 hour down, 2 hours to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Tim gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is. And you'll hear from Michael Remus periodically throughout the broadcast. Gentlemen, last Saturday we spent an hour discussing Brian Little. He's an RFA for the Winnipeg Jets. We had done, Richard, you had done a contract analysis of his situation for IllegalCurve.com. This Saturday we're going to spend an hour talking about Zach Bogosian. Similar topic. He's an RFA for the Winnipeg Jets. He's an arbitration eligible RFA, and you also did the contract analysis. Michael Remus will tweet that out right now on our Twitter page at Illegal Curve in case you missed the article when it was initially posted. The question I have for you to start with the Zach Bogosian analysis. Has he done enough in these past 2 years to be declared a clear-cut number one NHL defenseman?
No, I don't think he has, Drew, and I don't think he's fallen completely well short of that mark, but I don't think he's proven himself to be that guy. To me, the number one defenseman, I know there aren't a ton necessarily of how I categorize him, but you know, the Chara, Doughty, Duncan Keith, all those kind of guys, he's not in that class, but to me he has grown by leaps and bounds over the course of the last two seasons, and he's, I think, solidified himself as a top four defenseman, working his way to the two hole, and whether, you know, he can make that next step is an interesting question.
And still, 2008 draft, Bogo's only 22, still extremely young, and we know that defense is a harder position to grow into. It really is. And you look at it, anyone. I mean, to be a Drew Doughty is very, very difficult. I mean, like Dougie Hamilton, I think everyone will agree, is going through growing pains, and that's why he's in and out of the Boston lineup. But, Drew, to answer your question, I don't think you can maybe call Bogo a number one defenseman at this point. But for me, it's unquestionable that he is the future franchise defenseman along with Jacob Trouba. And I think, and Richie is factoring this in as well in his contract. It's funny, by the way, Richie, I remember when the Jets first came back, you did a contract article about Bogo, and then he signed his 2-year deal. It seems like that was just yesterday that we were talking about Bogo signing his second contract after his entry-level deal. But I think that he is, for me, it's unquestionable. I mean, you guys might disagree with it, but I think you're signing him for his future potential. And the only question I have about his game, because I don't have many questions about his game, I think he's a completely raw talent, and I think he's physically imposing, and he's going to get better offensive numbers, I think, as his career goes on. It's the injury concerns and that he had this year. And I'm not saying that I think he's going to get injured every year, but that's the only thing. And that's why, you know, when Richie was doing this, you have to factor that in a little bit. He had the wrist surgery, and that hurts it a little bit. But I think he did take a step forward. I know I'm giving you kind of a bit of a long-winded answer, but I think he did take a step forward this year, even though he only played, what, 30 games?
Let me ask you this. Pros and cons to his game. Or actually, before we get to that, as you mentioned that you think he's the future cornerstone of the Jets' defense. Is he the best defenseman?
Along
with Jacob Trouba. Yep. Trouba's still, I mean, he hasn't played a game in the NHL, so let's maybe rein in our expectations on that kid for this time being.
Yep.
Is Zach Bogosian the best defenseman on the Winnipeg Jets roster?
I think he is. I really think he is because, you know, just quickly, I'll let Richie get in here. You know, Toby Enstrom got the 6-year contract last year, last summer. So there's a commitment from the Jets to Toby Enstrom, and Buff's under contract for a few more years. But I think when you look at, you know, their overall game, I think, you know, Richie, that Bogo's still unpolished. I think he does... He's getting better, and there's things about his game that need to improve. But overall, I mean, there's not much to not like about Bogo's game. He's physically imposing. He'll even drop the gloves once in a while, and he's got a good shot, and it's getting better. And I think that when you factor in each side of the game, I do think he's the best defenseman that we currently have. Yeah, I do think that.
I think overall, Drew, he probably is the best defenseman on the roster right now because of the combination, as you mentioned, the combination of defensive ability and offensive ability. I think when you're asking that question, you're really asking who's the best of Dustin Byfuglien, Tobias Enstrom, and Zach Bogosian. I don't think anybody else is in that class.
Right.
And I think, you know, the what Byfuglien gives you offensively, which is a great deal of offense, I think Bogosian, what he gives you defensively, outweighs... it's hard to outweigh Byfuglien, but it outweighs Byfuglien's offensive contributions. In terms of Enstrom is a player that I think, you know, is kind of, it's interesting. His extension hasn't even kicked in yet, and a lot of people I speak to, you know, kind of want to see him out the door. I think his past actually indicates that he's quite reliable health-wise. He's just been injured these past 2 years.
Yeah.
Prior to that, he wasn't injured.
It's true, in Atlanta, he didn't miss a lot of time.
The Jets need a left-side guy, and I think Enstrom is being unfairly criticized in many respects.
I think overall,
he's not big enough and not good enough defensively, so I think if you're looking at an overall spectrum, if Bogosian can take the next step or even kind of play as he did this year and a little bit better, he's probably your top guy. Is he a number one NHL defenseman of the top class? No. But I think he's more of a number two guy right now. And that's a nice step for him because before that, I don't think he was that.
Okay, then let me just follow up on that one. Does he have it in his game? Do you see him developing further to be a number one?
Absolutely.
Maybe not in the Doughty Chara level, but being the number one defenseman on a good playoff team.
I do. Richie, I do. Because I should preface this. I'm a fan of Bogos. Absolutely. But even, having said that, I think that there are the physical tools, the smarts, the drive. Remember, towards the end of the season, Bogo got injured, and he was, the guy wants to win, and he always gives 100% on the ice. I do think that he can turn into a shutdown defenseman like a Duncan Keith. He's physically imposing, and I do think that he will turn into that. I think that we're going to see his best in the next few years. I really do.
You know, you really asked that question, and I think it really comes down to it. I think defensively he's rounding out quite well.
Yep.
His awareness, I think his hockey awareness has become better over the past little bit. Offensively, I thought he picked his spots a lot better this year in terms of when he's joining the rush, especially at the end of the season. You could really see him joining the rush, coming in with his big slap shot, getting the puck out of the zone better. Does he have the touch and that offensive instincts of those guys, those top guys who end up being dominating both ways? I'm not so sure he does. You could argue whether or not that can be developed. But, let's put it this way. When, we talk, people like to criticize Buffalo and all that, but when Buffalo was out, or Enstrom was out, more importantly, I guess Enstrom was out on the power play, it wasn't like Bogosian was stepping up there and just completely quarterbacking and making it look seamless. So I think sometimes people underrate the Enstrom's quiet puck moving ability. So he hasn't shown to be that guy yet. You could argue whether or not he can be, but I think that's an interesting question, and I think that has to factor into the numbers. We'll talk about them within this hour of what you pay him. I mean, he's not Drew Doughty, and not many players are. But when you're talking numbers wise, you can't be paying him that number because he's not as dominant, and he's a good defenseman right now. He's not a great defenseman. He's a really good defenseman. And the question is, internally, can the Jets develop him? And Charlie Hattie's done a nice job. Claude Noel, he's done a nice job thus far. He's a guy who seems to like it in town, too. But can he continue to develop him to take the next step? And as you mentioned, Jacob Trouba. If Jacob Trouba is everything that everybody says he is,
it's almost
some point, it's just, you don't even need him to be as amazing. He can just be really good.
Absolutely.
He can be the best Zach Bogosian he can be. He doesn't have to be a great other player. Like you said, a Doughty or whatnot. Pros and cons to his game. What's the biggest pro and con you see to Bogosian's game?
I just wanted to say,
sorry.
I mean, that's fine. Jacob Trouba, I think you are right, though, Drew. He hasn't played an NHL game, but from his performance at the University of Michigan and at the World Juniors, it looks like we have another Bogosian on our hands, and that means that we're in pretty good hands moving forward. But I think pros and cons, I think Bogo, as I mentioned before, I think speed and size combination on defense is, there's just not a lot of guys that have that. I mean, you're talking like almost like a Seth Jones type of build, Bogo. And to me, that's his greatest asset. And he's physical, always is good position and all that. And he does have a touch, and I think the offensive touch, I should say. And I think that that's going to get better. And I think you could see he was working on his shot all year, and he was missing the net a lot. And he took a lot of criticism for missing the net. And I think as the season went on, he got better. He got a few goals, but I think he's going to start to add that element to his game and become better on the power play and all that. As far as cons go, I think that, he isn't the most offensively creative guy. And I think sometimes, Richie mentioned, is he going to turn into a player that, in the Duncan Keith mold or a guy that's going to become a 60-point defenseman? I don't know if he's, or a Drew Doughty, I don't know if he's ever going to be a 60-point defenseman, but I think he'll be a solid 40-point defenseman. And I think if there's one drawback, it's, that he doesn't have the scoring touch of a guy like Enstrom. I mean, guys, remember, Enstrom was leading all defensemen in scoring until he got injured early in the season. I mean, Enstrom, for all his defensive flaws, is one of the best offensive defensemen in the NHL. So I think Bogo is, I don't think he's got elite offensive talent, and I think that's why he's going to, I see him moving forward being more of a kind of shutdown guy. And that's what I think essentially you want those guys on your team.
Strengths and weaknesses?
Yeah.
I mean, he's as good of a skater as I've seen in person. I mean, the guy can cut up the ice. He's a brilliant skater. And I think what was happening later in the year was he was realizing I can come into the play and I can get back and it's not going to be an issue. Some defensemen can get into the play, but they can't get back in time. Bogosian can. And I thought he was doing that a lot better and joining the rush, especially in the day and age, in this day and age of hockey where the defensive zone and the neutral zone is so cramped up and they're always holding a forward high. You need defensemen to join the rush to make 3-on-3s, 4-on-3s, or 2-on-2s, 3-on-2s, and things like that. So I think that's important. He's got a really good shot when he hits it on net, of course. He's physical. He seems to be taking on a leadership role.
Yep.
He can log big minutes, and he doesn't seem to be affected by that at all. So he's a horse. Deficiencies, I think he's become better. Sometimes his feel for the game does make the best reads. His touch sometimes and his passing ability in the offensive zone, I think he's sometimes a little bit too hard, not soft enough, not patient enough. With time, I think that probably will improve. But there's not a ton, it's not like the guy has a ton of flaws. Just I think when you're comparing him to the likes of the players that we're comparing him to, or at least discussing, it's hard to be in that category.
Let's go to break. When we come back on the other side, we're going to talk about the contract comparables that we think are viable for Zach Bogosian. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're talking about Zach Bogosian live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. We're talking about Zach Bogosian trying to break down and analyze what we expect he's going to get as a restricted free agent this offseason. Love to hear from you. You can send us your comments on Twitter, at Illegal Curve is the place to tweet it. And some good comments, we'll read them on air. How about that?
I want to hear what people have to say because, as you know, mm-hmm. I imagine this happens at your place of employment as well.
Yes.
And Illegal Curve fans, I do have a full-time day job. People ask me about that quite a bit, actually, because I tweet so much. They're like, do you actually do anything?
And your employer actually asks you that, too.
Yeah. No, but people always ask, okay, what are you guys talking about, right?
Yeah.
Like a coworker of mine was asking us, and I mentioned Bogo, and he didn't know that Bogosian's contract was coming up. And I think Bogosian is a fan. I think we'd agree that Bogo is a fan favorite. Not that Little and Wheeler aren't, but I think, he's become kind of up there with Bufflin and Ladd as kind of like the most popular guys around town, and he's a young guy. And I think that when I told someone about that, they kind of said, is he going to get a 6 or 7 year deal? So I'd like to hear what people on Twitter have to say because, most people think that Bogosian should get 5 to 6 year deal based on how he plays and how well liked he is.
Okay. Richie, in the article you mentioned the comparables. Mm-hmm. Players who are currently in the NHL who have signed similar contracts and been in similar situations to Zach Bogosian. The guys you mentioned, you mentioned five guys. The first one was Drew Doughty.
Are you talking about what you're going after the show?
You're talking about five guys, burgers and fries?
Oh, that's very clever. That's clever. That's okay, funny.
Five,
I was trying to figure out what...
Five defensemen.
I was trying to think of a pun with Doughty there, and I didn't see it. But Doughty was the first guy you mentioned.
We never Doughty you, Drew.
Yeah, nice. Doughty was the first guy you mentioned, but he's at the upper echelon of NHL defensemen.
Well, I think when you're doing a contract breakdown and you're looking at comparables, Drew, well, at least I thought with the Kane situation, you'd start at John Tavares and work your way down. That didn't end up happening. But the idea is you pick a guy at the top and you say, okay, let's be honest here. Both sides know. Kevin Cheveldayoff knows, and Zach Bogosian's agent, Bob Murray, knows, hey, he's not better than Drew Doughty, so let's just start. Cheveldayoff would say that is the point right there where we're not going above, and let's work below.
Sure. Okay. And then the other four guys you mentioned, there's Brent Burns.
Yeah, Brent Burns, who is a guy, obviously he's playing forward a little bit now, so and we don't know if that's going to be for the future or not. But Brent Burns is a guy, for the most part, he's a right-handed shooting,
mm-hmm.
number, top-pairing defenseman,
mm-hmm.
a little more offensively inclined. But a guy, of somewhat similar skill set.
The other guy you mentioned was Alex Edler, the Vancouver Canucks.
More of an offensively based guy. A bit like a truck, too, and he can be physical, but more offense to his game than Zach Bogosian. But a player, again, who's signed a contract in a similar contractual situation. He logs If you look at the minutes he's logging, at even strength, he's logging 18 minutes a game. And if you look at Bogosian, Bogosian's logging basically 18 minutes a game over the past 3 years. So they're logging similar even strength ice time. Edler's playing more on the power play than Bogosian. But overall, we looked at five players who are logging fairly similar minutes to the Jets' Zach Bogosian.
Braden Coburn, the Philadelphia Flyers.
Braden Coburn, of course, was Atlanta Thrashers.
Could have been Winnipeg Jet.
Yeah, could have been Winnipeg Jet. Braden Coburn is a guy...
Is that the Zhitnik trade?
Yeah, that was a good one. Braden Coburn is a guy who skates really well, maybe never came into the offensive and physical guy that people thought when he was drafted in the high in the first round, but a guy who has become a little bit more physical, can make a nice first pass, moves really well for a big guy, and plays 18 minutes a game, and has for the past 3 years, even strength, doesn't get a lot of power play time, but is relied on defensively, blocks and shots and hits, and he's a really good defenseman. And he just signed a contract.
And the final guy is Marc-Edouard Vlasic.
A guy who, you know, Ray Ferraro started to talk him up a bit if you watch TSN's broadcast of the Kings and Sharks.
Very solid defenseman.
Yeah, he's a very solid defenseman. Yeah. He's a good skater. He goes about his business well. Kind of Bogosian that way in that, you know, you don't hear too much about him, maybe in larger circles, but he does his job, and he does it quite well. He came up as more of an offensive guy, and over time, maybe that expectation has... The Sharks' expectation for him offensively has lessened a little bit, but overall he's still relied on heavily in a really an all around role at 5-on-5.
I think, you know, just quickly, Drew. Yeah. As far as these comparables go, I think Richie's bang on again. He always is with these articles. He's not Drew Doughty. There aren't
Richie's not Drew Doughty or Zach Bogosian's not Drew Doughty.
Zach Bogosian isn't Drew Doughty, and he's okay. Right. When Zach Bogosian's agent is negotiating with Chevy, he will use guys like this. And I look at, you know, Brent Burns, and let's put Brent Burns aside for a second just because he's playing forward now. But you look at, you know, Edler and Coburn. I'd say Edler, you know, has put up more offensive numbers. Yep. And Coburn is a better defensive defenseman. I think he is a candidate. I don't know if he's fallen off the radar a little bit for the 2014 Canadian team at the Olympics, but he's on the radar. Very good defenseman. I think Vlasic is the guy to me that is probably the best comparable. But Bogo's a guy where... It's tough to find another guy like him in the NHL. It really is because, like we said, the guy skates arguably as good as anybody, now, maybe better than Doughty even, but he doesn't have that offensive touch of guys like Edler, Doughty, Chara. So he's not quite in that upper echelon, but he's just below there.
Just to qualify, when you're talking about these comparables, we're talking about players who have signed contracts in similar situations.
Yeah. Right.
A guy like, people will say, well, why don't you compare him to a guy like Alex Pietrangelo, right-handed shooting guy, skates well. Well, he's in the same situation in terms of coming up for a contract, so why would we compare him to a guy who hasn't signed a deal?
Richie didn't pick these defensemen necessarily that have similar types of games as Bogo. I'm just saying I think probably Vlasic is the most close in similar types of games.
To some degree, they have similar skill sets, but they are also in this contract situation in the last couple of years where Bogosian is a restricted free agent, albeit he's one who now has arbitration eligibility, and by all accounts... It seems like he's the type of player that the Jets would want to keep under contract for a significant number of years.
Yep.
So let me ask you, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, as far as this contract analysis goes, Richie, I really truly believe that you're paying him for his potential, more so as a future shutdown defenseman, not a guy that's going to run the power play and score 50 points every year, because I think you've got that in Enstrom.
Let me interrupt you right there, Ezzy. You said you're paying him for a lot of his potential.
Yep.
Let me ask you this question.
What he's currently doing,
certainly, because it's not, I mean, he's not like he doesn't have a decent body of work already with him. Let me ask you this, Richard. I'll start with you. What is his ceiling? Pick a player in the NHL. If Zach Bogosian reaches, you know, his ceiling, who does he best resemble?
Well, that's a tough question to answer, Drew. I mean, finding comparables. I mean, he's got a little bit of a unique skill set. So you're talking about like what he tops out at?
Yeah. I mean, he's not going to be an offensive dynamo. I think we all know that. But he still has some room to grow offensively, right?
Yes, I think he does.
And would you think, and he's probably...
Off the top of my head, you're looking at a guy like a Brent Seabrook kind of guy.
It's funny, I was thinking that.
Right-handed shooting, first pairing defenseman, certainly can add in some offense, but isn't relied on to be the offensive guy. He moves around the ice better than Seabrook, but I'm talking about kind of stealing a top-end guy who can play, take you to the cup, be relied on, the leader, do a bunch of those things. So he's the kind of guy.
Another guy that popped in my head, Richie, was Jay Bouwmeester, but he's more physical than Jay Bouwmeester.
Yeah.
But that type of skating ability, Zach Bogosian, again, has top elite skating ability. He does. That's why he was drafted so high, and he was a sought-after prospect. I mean, the guy is an unbelievable hockey player. And, you know, still scored 30 points in his fourth year in the NHL as a 21-year-old, and this year, you know, had the 14 points but only played in 30 games. I mean, when Bogosian's out of the lineup, it's tough to replace him. It's impossible to replace him. He's one of the guys that I think the Jets missed the most when he was out of the lineup. I really think Bogo not being in the lineup is worse than even an Enstrom or a Bufflin in the lineup. I really do.
Time on ice. You look at him, and the Jets have sort of been bringing him along a little bit slowly in terms of even strength time on ice. You know, it was 18:25 his last year in Atlanta. Then it was 17:51 as he got acquainted here with the Jets. And last year it was 19:23.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can he be one of those horses,
yep,
you know, that can play 25 minutes a game?
Oh, he basically became that last year, Drew. I think what happened was Craig Ramsey had a little more trust in him. Noel curbed that a little bit, put up his power play and shorthanded time more, but at even strength, he wasn't relying on him as much. And I think he realized, you know, Zach Bogosian is probably our best 5-on-5 guy to play against the other team's top players.
Yep.
And he was used against the top players this year,
yeah,
similar to how he was used by Craig Ramsey. And then he bumped up his ice time this year to 19:25 at even strength a game. And I think you want to start from that base and then add in the power play time as opposed to the opposite, which he kind of did last year.
I'll tell you what, let's go to break here, and we'll come back. I'm going to talk about some of the, is there an offer sheet possibility for Zach Bogosian? Would the Jets consider trading him, perhaps? We don't really expect that, but we can talk about it. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're talking about Zach Bogosian live on TSN 1290.